right after doing those two. And those are just the Department of Education, not the higher education items. As soon as Rocco gets here.
What do you want me to do, Chief?
Go get
if Rocco's out there.
I'm supposed to be tracking him down.
It's early for him to get here.
We can do it without him. Board Education Subcommittee for September 21st, 2006. We are going to go, as always, as thoroughly as necessary through each one of these items, but as expeditiously as possible also. There is one change in the schedule, and that is after item number 45, I will move up items 5 and 6, and then I will come back to item 3 after doing those two items. I wanted to state one thing on the record here because it has come up in the discussion with the subcommittee chairs. In each of the subcommittees, there are grant proposals, some of them that had the proper notification to leadership and some that did not. Each subcommittee actually has at least one grant proposal that did not have the timely notification of leadership. That's been an item of discussion, particularly in our meeting yesterday, and while most of us are in agreement, we're all in agreement actually, that the item should go forward. We don't want to see this repeated. And I'm saying this now so it's not just simply reflected on one agency, but I know that a lot of you will leave after your item has been considered. So if you have any grant proposals that you haven't informed leadership of, please do so in an expeditious manner. We'll proceed to items 1 and 2. Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, these are two grant awards to the Judicial Department, and in both cases they met this deadline, so that your message doesn't apply to them.
Okay. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations with the Judicial Department, and we're here this morning on two different grant applications. The first is a juvenile court improvement grant. It's a federal grant. We were actually very surprised by the availability of this grant. The money was passed in the Deficit Reduction Act. So for Congress to decide that the courts should have the benefit of some additional funding in the Deficit Reduction Act actually caught us by surprise. But these two grants are kind of add-ons to our court improvement base grant that we've had for years. One is for work on data. It is going to help us really enhance our work on the performance measures that Senator Schrader has been so kindly supportive of. The other is a training grant, and both of those have to do with improving the court's performance in child abuse and neglect cases. The bottom line that we're asking today is to increase our federal fund limitation in the amount of $298,354 and establish two limited duration positions, which at this point in the biennium is 0.75 FTE. And that's the very short version. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Staff here.
Mr. Chair, DAS doesn't make recommendations on the judicial branch.
Oh. Okay, you're special. I have forgotten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, this LFO.
Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of the request to increase federal funds expenditure limitation by $298,354 and authorize the establishment of two limited duration positions, 0.75 FTE.
I move that. Sir.
Is there any additional discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the second item is our request to...
Yes.
Our second item is our request to approve the drug court funding that was approved by the Criminal Justice Commission. As all of you know, the legislature last session set aside $2.5 million in general fund money for the enhancement of drug court programs in your methamphetamine package. Our courts were actively involved in working with the Criminal Justice Commission on the grant program, and we did have five courts awarded enhancement grants. So the nature of our request is to please approve an increase in other fund spending authority for $275,034 and the establishment of five limited duration positions, which at this point is 1.29 FTE. And I know that you care about this. We will come to the legislature asking to have those positions continued in the Judicial Department's budget next biennium.
LFO recommendation.
Ms. Chair, LFO recommends approval of the request to increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $275,034 and authorize the establishment of five limited duration drug court coordinator positions, 1.29 FTE.
The LFO recommendation.
Any discussion? We have a motion on the table. Any objection? Hearing no objection, the motion passes.
Thank you all very much.
Representative Scott, will you take that item?
Sure.
Okay, we will now go to the Department of Transportation. Wait for Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
Okay, if you want to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Department of Transportation is here on four items. One of them is to get an increase in limitation for debt service on Connect Oregon and a couple of rail projects that need additional limitation. They're requesting increase in limitation for their highway maintenance program due to increased costs for fuel and material. And to seek an increase in limitation for reimbursement of costs for emergency slide and storm damage repair on highways, and to rebalance their non-limited budget authority in an expenditure limitation.
Please come forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation here on the first item that Susie referenced, which is the debt service limitations for the Short Line, Industrial Spur, South Metro Commuter Rail, and Connect Oregon programs. In the 2005 legislative session, the legislature approved Senate Bill 71 to finance $100 million in Connect Oregon program non-highway transportation projects. In June 2006, the Emergency Board approved expenditure limitations increases for Connect Oregon, but delayed approval of the debt service until after the August 2006 $25 million bonding. That bond sale is completed now. We know the exact amount of the debt service. That is $613,708. We're requesting that for the 0507 biennium. The second debt service area is 2001 session, which relates to $35 million in lottery-backed bonds for the South Metro Commuter Rail Project. This was from the Wilsonville area to Beaverton. Bonds were issued in 2002 for startup and administration costs for the project, and the legislature extended the project in the 2005 session. We're back this time, not for the money for the project itself, because the project will and the bonding will be done late enough in the current biennium that we do not need debt service for the project. We do need, however, $43,942 of expenditure limitation just for the startup expenses for the project. Lastly is a 2001 legislative session action, which approved $2 million for lottery bonds for improvements on short line railroads, as well as a 2003 action for $8 million in lottery bonds for the industrial rail spur projects, which were to provide access between manufacturers and the main line The bonds were refinanced and debt service estimate was lower by $228 for the short lines and $1 for the industrial rail spurs. Unfortunately, we need to come back for your approval to get those limitations increased. Mr. Chair and members, I'm open to questions.
Okay. Any questions at this time? Yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question on the Connect Oregon. And I may be incorrect on this, but I thought that in a meeting with the treasurer a few days ago, I thought I understood him to say that only $25 million of the bonds have been sold.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, that's correct. And that's all the debt service that we're seeking at this time.
Okay, so we still have 75.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Dance.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jim Carboni from the Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. We do recommend approval of this.
Okay. LFO.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends approval of the request with a modification to increase lottery funds expenditure limitation for debt service for short line program by $228 and the lottery funds expenditure limitation for the industrial rail spur program by $1. And while it's not part of our recommendation, Legislative Fiscal Office is also recommending that the Department of Administrative Services and the Secretary of State's Audits Division work together to develop a policy that would allow payment of these types of expenses without requiring an appearance before the emergency board. The cost to process this kind of a request is significantly more than an adjustment of an immaterial nature.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I agree with Ms. Jordan's approach to future requests of this minuscule nature so that we save everybody money. Look forward to DAS and Secretary of State coming forward with some sort of policy for us next session. Having said that, I would move the request with the modification by LFO to establish the lottery funds expenditure $613,708 for debt service on Senate Bill 71. Have lottery funds expenditure limitation of $43,942 for the South Metro project. An increase the expenditure limitation for debt service for the short line by $228 and lottery funds expenditure limitation for the debt service for industrial rest of the infrastructure by $1.
Is there a motion on the table? Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Senator Morse, will you take that one?
Yes.
Okay. Item 43.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation. This request pertains to costs that we're seeing resulting from some significant inflation in a couple of areas that are impacting us, fuel and some of the materials that we use to maintain the highways, particularly asphalt and cement. Steel has somewhat leveled out. But we've seen almost unprecedented increases in just huge increases in these costs. Asphalt has gone up almost double in price in the past year. And this is impacting our ability to deliver the maintenance services at the level that the public has become accustomed to them. Recognizing this problem, the Oregon Transportation Commission agreed to allocate $10 million to the maintenance limitations so that we can keep the levels of service as close to the past levels of service as possible, particularly pertaining to winter maintenance. So this request is to offset the almost unprecedented increases in inflation in some of the fuel and materials that we commonly use in maintenance. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Seeing none, the DAS recommendation.
Department of Administrative Services does recommend approval, Mr. Chair.
LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we concur with that recommendation.
Do we have a motion?
So moved. So moved.
It's been moved. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. I will take that item. Item 44.
Chair Devlin, Doug Tindall again. This request also pertains to the maintenance limitation, a little bit different reasoning for this one. In the past winter, we experienced a large amount of extraordinary damage due to winter storms. This request, I think this is a good news request. This actually comes with money from the federal government. There's a standard process in place when you have extraordinary or catastrophic damage to federal aid highways, that the federal government has an emergency relief fund. We apply for that, and we have already received money, the $22 million, to fund the repairs on the federal aid system that we, from the damage, the unanticipated damage that we experienced last winter. So this simply gives us the limitation to be able to spend that. Similar to the last request, not having a limitation to spend the money that we got from the federal government would impact our ability to keep our maintenance levels of service at the current level. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Department of Administrative Services.
Chair, the Department of Administrative Services does recommend approval of this request.
Legislative Fiscal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LFO also recommends approval of the request.
Is there a motion?
Move the request.
Any discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes.
Representative, be happy to.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Item number 45.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh again, here on our request dealing with non-limited expenditures. I think the members are aware that some departments have internal services that support frontline expenditures, and those are oftentimes dealt with non-limited expenditures. The 2005 session deleted non-limited authority for use on these internal service kinds of functions. We'd like to make sure we can maintain the service level to non-ODOT entities that are getting services from these entities. The first is a category of reimbursable program, which is self-funded and is responsible for repairing department property, such as guardrail, when it's damaged by a third party. And we go back and make sure we get the recovery of that from insurance companies or the third-party person that damaged the facility. When the non-limited authorization was abolished at the last session, there was not continued expenditure limitation to allow for that function to continue. That's $12.2 million, so we request expenditure limitation for that function. Secondly is the fleet vehicle services and related expenditures, which were put into the maintenance limitation when the non-limited authority was abolished. A portion of the fleet expenditures are actually used by other state agencies, such as state police, in order to cover those services to them in cities and counties. We need to have an expenditure limitation increase of $2.8 million. The third area is traffic signal services, which were moved from non-limited to special programs and provide traffic signal services, such as maintenance, inspection, and testing of signals. This estimated amount for that is $420,000 of expenditure limitation. Lastly is a photo video unit, which was moved from non-limited to the central services limitation. It includes things like aerial photography, general reprographic services, graphic design, and video services, which are done for other agencies like the Department of Human Services and Department of Justice, as well as others. The additional expenditure limitation there is about $231,000. We understand and concur with the LFO recommendation that DAS will unschedule the funds and release funds when the actual need is demonstrated. Mr. Chair, I'm open to questions.
Department of Administrative Services.
Chair, Department of Administrative Services does agree with the recommendation of the LFO.
Legislative Fiscal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the LFO's recommendation is to approve the request with the understanding that DAS will unschedule the difference between the biannualized figures and the amount requested by the agency until the actual need is demonstrated.
Is there a motion?
I'll move the LFO recommendation.
Okay. Is there any additional discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll take that. Okay. We will stand at ease for about 60 seconds. Representative Cupp, can I speak to you? Just a second. Five. Mr. Hill.
Is that a morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm Sue McGlashan with the Office of Finance and Administration at the Department of Education. Yes, I have moved yet again. With me is Nancy Latini, Assistant Superintendent at the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships with the Department of Education. And we are here this morning to request allocation of a reservation of $3,009,549 in the E-Fund for unexpected increases in the early intervention, early childhood special education program. And you might recall that the Emergency Board established this reservation in June when the department appeared before the board with a request for this funding amount. And the E-Board decided to defer the department's request until September so that more information on the cost and timing of other demands on the E-Fund could be gathered. And with that, I'll stop and turn this over to Nancy, who will provide you with more detail on our request and answer any questions you have.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Latini, and I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnership. I'm here today, as Sue said, to give you a status report based on the information I shared with you in June when we deferred this request until now. As you know, the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program serves children with disabilities and their families. The purpose of the program is to prepare children and families for school, and hopefully for some of the children, we're going to defer and delay any other more serious disabilities if we get them early enough. But for some of the children with severe disabilities, it's a matter of finding the right supports and services and helping the families understand that impact on the disability, and so as to provide the schools with information about what's needed to defer any serious lack of progress in school, and to help the parents in supporting schools in that effort of making these children perform better. The early intervention part of the program serves children birth through age 2, and this is state mandated. The early childhood special education program serves children from ages 3 up to enrollment in kindergarten, which is usually age 5, and their families. The department is charged with running both of these programs, and we do this with contracts through 9 educational service districts who then provide the services and assume the responsibilities for compliance and for program performance. The legislature directed the early intervention program to bill for Medicaid to try to secure more money to run that program, but because Oregon runs a seamless system of birth through age 5, we require both programs to bill for Medicaid, and I'll talk a little bit more about that when I get to the funding. In the 2003-2005 biennium, we experienced a very low and limited growth in the program, and at that time there was a special appropriation set aside that we did not ask for. We didn't feel we could justify asking for it. The story became much different after that time. The growth has been significant, and it was so significant that the department came back in October and requested the full special appropriation set aside in order to run the program, because there already had been an average increase of about 5.3%, and the programs were struggling financially to keep up with the children as they were coming in to maintain the quality program and staff. We suspected in October that our caseloads were going to continue to grow, and we did say we might have to come back, and we did come back in June, as you know. Our updated caseloads show still another increase of about 4.6%, and I think you have a chart that shows that growth over time. The federal funding has not increased, and actually, for the first time since the 70s, we're hearing conversation about a potential decrease in federal funding for special education. It hasn't happened at this point, but it certainly hasn't grown and has remained flat. The Medicaid money really remains a struggle still for us. The programs are trying their best to get the reimbursements, but the rules keep changing, and quite frankly, several years ago, there was a couple audits in our school districts that got punished for some errors that they thought they made when they were actually thinking they were doing it right, and so people are kind of afraid and they're very cautious. We're working right now very closely with the Department of Human Services to try to curb any federal changes in the Medicaid reimbursement for school programs, and again, trying to work with our schools and making sure that we can ease some way of making sure this is that we're asking for reimbursement correctly and timely. Since our October presentation, we've been hearing about efficiencies that the programs have been practicing. In June, I gave you a list of those efficiencies, and the staff, I believe, are still trying very hard to continue to try to stretch their resources and continue to serve the children. We're actually looking for an outside consultant to come and help us in case we're missing some efficiencies that we're not looking at. You know, when you get so so close inside, you keep doing the same thing, and there might be other things to do that could help us to be more efficient. So we're trying that at the same time. There also, the programs are exercising some different efficiency moves right now. The 9 superintendents that are responsible for these programs shared some of those activities right now with me of cutting hours for staff, not cutting staff fully, but cutting back on hours. They're eliminating professional development. They're curbing services to the absolute minimum that the federal law allows. And they're moving some of the staff onto their Medicaid dollars, which, as you can probably guess, when you start putting personnel on there, the money gets eaten up much quicker than it does for professional development or equipment and materials and things that the children need. A few of the staff have resigned because they were afraid of the uncertainty of funding. And in special education, you know that staff will find other jobs because there is such a shortage in special education. Another concern that came up from one of the ESDs that was interesting to me that I hadn't thought about was there are certain activities that the ESDs with these contracts can move off to districts to do, and that is child find, the assessment of early childhood children, and also the meetings that you have to determine eligibility. And some of the ESDs now, in order to stretch their funds for services, are asking districts to do that. You can imagine the strain that puts on districts that are already strapped in special education. And probably the hardest part for me is there's a whole different set of rules for early childhood federal law than there is for school age, so now the districts are trying to meet those as well. And, of course, the ESDs aren't interested in straining that relationship with school districts. That was something else they're doing. All this to say that we're finding more young children that are eligible for services at this point. Staff is doing a good job at child finding and working with the medical community as well. And they're doing their best to try to meet the legal obligations. I appreciate the time to share this with you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions at this point? Yes.
Senator Morris. Yes. A couple of questions, if I may. Could you refresh our memory as to what the total cost of this program is?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, without the reservation today, but with the special purpose appropriation that was allocated by the emergency board last October, the general fund support for the program from the Department of Education is $89.6 million. The federal funds allocated to the programs through the Department of Education, and those are primarily IDEA funds, $33.4 million. We expect at most $2.6 million in Medicaid funding, for a total of $125.6 million for the biennium.
Thank you. There's a follow-up. So there is quite a bit of money at play in this program. And my question is, do we means test at all for those recipients? Family income?
Chair Devlin, Senator Morris, it is not income-based. We have 11 disability categories, and if the child, once they're identified, fall into one of those categories, we're required to serve them. Income doesn't matter, and we can't. They have to provide a free, appropriate public education for these children.
Just a follow-up?
Yes.
Is that a function of federal requirements or the fact that we've just not addressed it at a state level?
Senator Morris, it's definitely a federal requirement.
So there is no possibility of means testing the benefits in this program due to federal...
Yeah, the law states free and appropriate public education.
Thank you.
Any additional discussion of the DAS recommendation?
The Department of Administrative Services recommends approval of this request.
LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, LFO recommends that you allocate $3,009,549 from the Emergency Fund Reservation for the EIECSE program.
Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we approve the LFO recommendation and the request.
We have a motion on the table. Is there any additional discussion?
Yes, I look forward to the time. This is very good, very worthwhile, and I'm fully supportive. But I look forward to the time when we actually fully integrate all our early childhood services, you know, for children under 5. I mean, we have the DHS services, which you coordinate with. We have the Commission on Children and Families, which we coordinate with. And I think we're coming to a point, if we're going to go down the seamless K-12, K-20 system or pre-K-20 system, that we ought to be melding these things up front so that to get the total efficiencies, because do some cross-training where several personnel could serve several different functions for these young mothers trying to figure out how to deal with some very difficult situations with their children, whether it be nutritional or whether it be disabilities or the combination thereof. So just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Any additional comments? There is a motion that's already been made. Are there any objections? Hearing no objections, motion passes. I will take that. Okay. We will now move on to item number 6. And before we go to that, who's going to be here from? Are you going to be here from the Department of Education?
For this item, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yes.
Can I take 60 seconds?
Ms. McHugh, would you please...
Or not McHugh, I mean McLarson.
Change jobs, Mr. Chair, but not
First of all, Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the department is here to ask for retroactive submission of a federal grant concerning the effective behavioral and instructional support system.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move that we table this particular request until the December meeting for an unrelated reason. I'd like to, if you would indulge me, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman, I would like to share that with the committee and ask their support at this time. Sometimes government agencies behave badly. And in this case, the Department of Education has behaved badly towards the state's first virtual online public charter school, of which I am the chairman of the board. And sometimes our only way of sending them a message that they need to straighten up their act is to invoke the power of the purse. In this case, Mr. Chairman, if we delay this request, I don't think we're causing any great damages. If you've read the request, they've already asked for the grant. They have not had the grant approved to them as of yet, and they will need to come back to this body and ask for expenditure limitation if they receive the grant from the federal government. But I'm asking you to send me, help me send them a message, because our situation with them is not yet resolved. What they did is 2 days before we were to start school with 1,200 students in our second year of operation, the Department of Education cut off our money without having a conversation with us as to why. We asked them repeatedly, I as board chairman, our consultants, our principal, asked them repeatedly if they had concerns, because we knew something was coming, if they had concerns, come and talk to us about it. We'll work with you. But instead of that, they sent us a letter saying you're in violation of the law, both state and federal, which we passionately dispute, and that your money is now being placed in escrow. We then immediately sat down with them where they agreed to turn the spigot back on, if you were, and work it out with us. They could have done that priorly. This is the heavy hand of government. It was an unwarranted, unnecessary movement on their part. Now, some have alleged in the press that it's because we are their only competition. As you know, Senate Bill 1071, which we passed out of your committee, Senator, last session, basically, in its current configuration, grants the state a monopoly on future virtual, that's my editorial comment, by the way, it may not be a universal view, basically, they're spending millions of our tax dollars to develop a curriculum that we've already developed on the private sector for nothing. We are their competition. Last year, we operated for one full year. They had all of our information for a year. If they had concerns, they could have brought it up prior to us being granted a public charter through the Sile School District. They did not. They funded us for a year. And then 2 days before we start school with 1,200 students, and likely next year 3,000 students, they cut us off. It was unnecessary to do that. I'm asking you to help me send a message to them to not do act inappropriately towards us again and to enter into good faith negotiations with us. This issue is not resolved. We do not have a firm commitment from them, the details of their approval of what we've agreed to in our conversations with them.
That's why I'm asking you to join me to send them a message by simply agreeing to delay this request until the next e-board meeting, whereby we can grant it.
To keep this in proceeding in terms of considering the items that are before us, what I would ask the presenters to do would be to first address the actual grant application, then to address, if they choose to, the comments of Representative Crump, and then we'll get the DAS recommendation, the LFO recommendation, and then your motion is still on the table.
Yes, sir.
And I understand your motion to word it slightly differently, because we can't table in a subcommittee. It would be to recommend to the full committee that we defer action until the November meeting. That
yes,
would be.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Ms. McGlash.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, again, Sue McGlashan with the Office of Finance and Administration with the Department of Education, and with me is Nancy Latini, Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships with the Office, with the Department of Education. As Mr. Hill indicated, this is a request for retroactive approval to apply for a five-year, $5 million personnel development grant from the U.S. Department of Education. And in a nutshell, this would be for staff training and developing and using a system of support referred to as the Effective Behavioral and Instructional Support System, or EBIS. This grant requires no state match or cost sharing, and with that, I'll turn it over to Nancy for more detail on the request.
Chair Member Devlin, members of the committee, we were invited to submit a proposal to the U.S. Department of Education because of some of the work that we're doing in Oregon around systems building in our school districts. The grant opportunity would allow us actually to move quicker in the development of this and to keep pace with the requests at school districts and asking for our support. The U.S. Department sees the process that Oregon has developed or started as a venture last year as a model that could be used in other states, and they're clearly interested in trying to fund us to move faster to see if this system is going to work positively for the expected outcomes that the new federal law is expecting. The invitation was presented to us about 25 days before the deadline, and this was in July, and it was difficult to refuse an offer of about $5 million over 5 years that all went out to school districts and didn't sit in the department, even though we knew the timing for permission was wrong. The outcome of the grant then, as I said, would have a system of service delivery, both in the academic and behavioral supports, to assure that the neediest kids get targeted to the most direct services in the schools, and yet not overlooking all the children that are doing fine, but to attend to everybody in a systematic way. The schools would get the support that they would need to develop that capacity up front. And in addition to the schools being involved, we would involve DHS, Department of Human Services, for those children particularly with severe behavioral needs that need something more of the mental health services on a school behavior plan or some support in school. So the overall goal of this is to get the right services and supports to the right kids and yet not ignoring all of the kids in the school. None of the money, as Sue said, would go to staff at the department. The current staff would oversee the outcomes, but the funds then would be used to supply districts with their needed resources in terms of training, of trainers, and other materials. I believe you did get a copy of the proposal. I see Representative Crump looked at it, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
CAS recommendation.
CAS would recommend approval, Mr. Chair.
LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, since you pointed out earlier in this committee, this is one that did not meet the 10-day notification, and so I wanted to point that out. I have discussed it with the department, and I don't think that's going to be a problem again. There was some change in staff, including Ms. McGlashan's position. She's very aware of what the rules are, and she has promised me she'll do everything in her power to make sure it never happens again. With that being said, we would approve retroactively the submission of the federal grant.
Any additional comments from other members of the committee at this time?
On what, Mr. Chair? I have no additional comments on the proposal that's brought forward by the Department of Education.
On the motion that's before the committee, there is one area of agreement that I have with Representative Crump, and that is that the timing of the notification was indeed unfortunate. I would understand that any provider of public education would have a difficult time with that sort of timing. I personally will not support the motion. Senator Schrader, if you wanted to comment on either of the items that we're now discussing, please do so.
I share both Representative Krupp and your concern about the timing. I was pleased to read that that is being worked out and that the district itself seems to be willing to go along with some of those recommendations, and I have every faith that things will work out. And I personally am very excited about that charter school. I think it's a great opportunity. It's probably the flagship of what we're going to see, not as a monopoly, I don't think, under the chair's bill from last session, but as an opening of an appropriate virtual school system for all of Oregon, especially Eastern and Southern Oregon, that could hopefully engage in this in a big, big way. You're already helping a lot of those people with your school district. So I see this as the beginning of hopefully a good discussion, and we're going to learn as we go through this how we're going to have to do things slightly different. And unfortunately, this virtual school district is pioneering, and I think the department is trying to figure out its role in working with them to ensure the standards of education that we want for our kids. Having said that, I as a co-chair of Ways and Means at one point in the past, just a little concerned about the precedent this sort of action would set. I think bringing and raising this concern is good, and I think sends a message in and of itself about how the timing and how we're going to work. The department has lost a lot of people, as we know, in the last few months, and I think that contributes to some of the difficulty in communicating perhaps effectively. But I would have trouble probably supporting this motion because of the precedent would set in bringing up unrelated matters, no matter how important they are, to affect actual requests that are before us, which I would like to think that the Ways and Means and the Emergency Board would try and stay on point with the particular requests that are before us at this point in time. And so for that, I probably have a tough time supporting that particular motion.
Representative Krupp, I'll give you an opportunity to speak.
Thank you. I appreciate the sentiments from both the senators and your comments well taken. You know, Oregon Connections Academy has, this year our enrollment is at 1,200. In about a week we should be about 1,500 to 1,600 students. 60% of our students are homeschooled students who have not previously been in the public educational system. We offer a complete curriculum this year from K through 9, and next year, as we're working with community colleges to develop advanced placement programs with them, we hope to offer a complete K-12 education. We have students all over the state. Our test results, I think, are outstanding. They're right where we thought they would be. And the key to our success is that we strongly recommend, which was one of the points of contention with the Department of Education, that you have parents or guardians monitor the activities of their children who are learning online with our teachers. Yes, we have real teachers. They're paid union scale. They're in the public employees retirement system. We have a bricks and mortar building in Sile that where our teachers sit in the same room. Parents hold their children accountable, and whether it's public education in the traditional sense, which I went through, and most of us did here, or whether it's in charter schools, parents are the key. Our program deeply encourages that. And it's being successful in many ways. I think we cannot allow an agency to act in a manner that this agency has, especially after we pleaded with them numerous times to talk with us. What is it that we can do to satisfy your concerns? And that's why I'm asking you to do this, because I think at times we have to do things that are symbolic. And Senator Schrader, I understand the process issues. Our government and our process here is about process. I think if we continue to allow them to go forward in these manners, and since this issue is not resolved, by the way, we do not have a final letter from the Oregon Department of Education agreeing to the things that we agreed to in our meeting with them to resolve this, where we basically did acquiesce to their concerns. That because it is not resolved, I think it is appropriate we take this action at this time to send that very strong message that they need to act in good faith. I believe they've acted in bad faith towards us. They did not have to do what they did. They could have called us ahead of time and said, we have concerns They're very serious. We need to sit down and talk with you, which is what they've done now, by the way. And we've had that conversation, but the process is not concluded, and I would ask for your help.
Okay. One final comment. Again, I will not be supporting the motion. I concur with all the comments of Senator Schrader. One of the things about 1071 that I think Senator Schrader commented on, but I'd probably like to elaborate on a little bit, it was never meant as an impediment to existing programs. It was meant as providing access to potentially all students across the state for online instruction. And while the Academy probably does an excellent job, there are a number of online providers in the state, a number of ESDs, a number of school districts, a number of community colleges, a number of our universities. And so it was to provide a broader access. Now, because this is a subcommittee and because of our rules, if this motion passes, it will go on to the full. I'm going to do something a little bit unusual here, and that is I'm going to ask Representative Scott to carry. Now, the reason I'm doing that is Representative Scott is part of leadership. And so if there is a discussion of what happens to this item at the full tomorrow, Representative Scott's in a good position to carry out whatever leadership's decision is on this. If that's, well, that's not really subject to discussion. But with that, the motion is on the table. Are there any objections to the motion? Noting two objections, Senator Devlin and Senator Schrader, the motion passes. The motion will be before the full committee tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scott, will you carry?
Reluctantly.
Just a point of clarification. The
recommendation is to defer until the November, defer approval of the grant application until November. That's not denial of approval to the grant application. That's to defer action on the grant application.
And Mr. Chairman, a quick note. What is the date of the November meetings?
I think it's early December.
Early December?
I think it's
November 30th, December 1st.
Well, if it gives you and the audience any comfort, I will not be here. I'll be in Afghanistan. So you won't have to worry about this issue coming before you again.
November 30th.
Okay. With that, the motion passes, and Representative Scott will carry. We will now go back to our normal agenda, the Public Defense Services Commission. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Ms. McHugh, do you want to give us a briefing?
Okay. This request is to allocate $7,853,000 from the emergency fund for costs of the Public Defense Services Commission. Our recommendation is to allocate half that amount, $3,926,500 from the emergency fund, and direct the agency to return to the November-December meeting of the emergency board or to the legislature during the 2007 session for the remainder of the funding needed. In question is not the need for the funds. The data is clear that that amount is necessary to get to pay for the cost of the Public Defense Services Commission through the biennium. The issue was simply that if all of the requests had been approved in this emergency board, we did not have enough emergency fund general purpose emergency fund available. In November, December meeting, we will have reversions from special purpose appropriations that we expect to be in the $10 to $12 million range, and so at that time you would have additional funding. In the meantime, given still outstanding issues about potential fires, et cetera, although it looks a little better out there, we chose to be somewhat conservative at this time.
Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Public Defense Services Commission and our Office of Public Defense Services. With me is Catherine Aylward, who's the Director of our Business Contract and Business Services Division, and she's really our Chief Budget Officer, responsible for our projections and managing the budget. And with us here in the audience, among the four of us, we should be able to answer all your questions, is two of our commission members, Chairman Barnes Ellis and Commissioner John Potter. I'll try to be as brief as possible and welcome your questions. As you can see from reading our report, historically we've been very accurate in our projections of caseload within a fraction of 1%. The problems for us is it's fine to have predictions, but we face unpredictable events. The most notable one, I think, during this biennium has been an opinion by the United States Supreme Court that this legislature and this committee is certainly familiar with, Blakely versus Washington, what those of us practicing in the area consider a radical opinion, although the author of the opinion, Antonin Scalia, wouldn't consider it. But it really did change sentencing law, certainly in states like Oregon that has a guideline system similar to Washington. It created an immense amount of appeals and challenges that's finally working its way through the system. So that disproportionate increase in appeals is to a significant degree due to the Blakely decision. These things happen frequently in the criminal justice system. Secondly, and you've dealt with this over the years, is the costs and consequences of prosecuting cases under the death penalty. And we've discovered that we have cases in our caseload that go back as far as 1986. The appeals go on over biennia. Sometimes the United States Supreme Court takes a case, decides an opinion, and then remands it to us. And those are costs that are, as you can see, considerable and exceed our projections. Then there's a category we call in our areas that where the services, the amount allocated for services really are exceeding inflation. We talked to you on many occasions about the attorney hourly rates, the guideline rate of $40. We simply haven't been able to obtain lawyers, particularly in complex cases, for that rate, and have had under our rules the authority, which we use sparingly, but the authority to raise those rates when we must. Another unpredictable, I'm kind of skipping in this category, is the interpreters. We were surprised to realize how many more interpreters we needed. This wasn't an increase in the rates, but the increase in the number of interpreters due to the changes. It's almost double from last biennium, the monthly expenditures, due to the increase in non-English speaking clients that we're involved with. Another category is non-attorney providers, and here I guess it's some professions are better than lawyers and demanding the market rates, and we required to have physicians, forensic experts in the trials. And while we negotiate with them at arm's length and try to keep those rates down, we simply have not been able to keep the rates as low as we'd like. They go elsewhere, the federal system, to testify in cases. So that's a cost that's increased. So in sum, we listed for you in our report those categories that we haven't been able to account for or are unpredictable, and hence we are here for a request of an allocation of $7.85 million to complete the operation of the public defense system through this biennium. As we understand, your legislative fiscal office, as has just been indicated, has indicated that recommendation of half, recognizing all of the demands on the fund. We're certainly pleased to have that amount. We would come back, and I think we certainly think it's sensible to require us to come back at the end of the biennium once we're definitely know what our caseload or these unpredictable factors are, and request an allocation for the remainder of the biennium. With that, thank you for your attention. Happy to answer your questions. Any questions?
So, Mr. Chairman, one. How do you could, and I know you probably don't have this information with you today, but if you could provide it to the members of the committee, I would appreciate it later. How do you compare in terms of your expenditures per caseload with surrounding states that may have similar issues with non-English speaking individuals, if that is a prime driver of where this is headed? If you could provide that at some point in time, or if you'd have an anecdotal response, I'd appreciate hearing it.
The chair might say that I think that one of the things you could provide is you gave the subcommittee during the regular session some information in terms of how much certain types of cases cost. And you might also have some additional that I don't know about comparison with other states. I can tell you if you are, not that anyone here would ever be accused, but if you're accused of a class C felony, I think you better hope you can afford legal counsel.
Chairman Devlin, Representative, I'm always willing to take a stab at answering questions, but I would like to appreciate the opportunity to supply you information. I'd like to back up and say if I were sitting in your chair, one of the things I would want to know constantly is how we compare with other states on a variety of things, and you asked that question in all the areas. The problem starting out of the blocks is every state runs its criminal justice system differently and is sometimes very difficult to determine. A case may be much more complex in one state than another, or less complex, and simply it's very hard to compare. We get apples and oranges. As to your specific question with ethnicity and diversity, I'd certainly be happy to provide that information, and it is changing rapidly, as we all know, particularly in the West, although even the rest of the country is seeing a much bigger change in the demographics of their population. And as you might imagine, it's pretty difficult for an attorney, not to mention a judge, to deal with folks who, without interpreters, who are accused of crimes. Be happy to provide that information.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In connection with that, with the question that Representative Krupp raises, I wonder if it might be possible, when you see significant differences between the Oregon's cost and other states' cost, if you could also indicate what you think that's related to. And I can immediately think of several differences in law that might result in differences in costs, but I don't know specifically what those might be, so that the legislature and the committee can understand better what the reasons are for those.
Well, Chairman Devlin, Representative, would be happy to do that. And, of course, is the simple answer, which you already know, is to the extent that the liabilities increase, in other words, the penalties for crime, and the stakes get higher, the prosecutor puts more resources into the defense much, that's probably the biggest dynamic, is what we call those mandatory minimum or fixed sentences that have been popular throughout the country. That's really driving a lot of the costs. And, of course, the prosecution and defense of death penalty cases is an enormous cost. But we'd be happy to provide you with that information ongoing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Morse and Senator Schrader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know what percentage of our public defense cost is attributed to immigrants that don't enjoy legal status?
Representative Devlin, Senator Morris, I don't. I wondered if Catherine does. I don't think we have that. Have you seen anything? We don't yet. I don't know. I guess we'd have to talk to the federal authorities first and figure that out, but we haven't tracked that.
Senator Schrader.
I think we should be tracking that in the future. I mean, that's a huge issue in our state right now, so I'd ask here that they do that in the future. A question for LFO, if I may, and that's the previous bulge we dealt with in 305. Mm-hmm. Was that rolled up as part of their base budget, or was that treated as, because it came late in the interim? How did we deal with that?
Senator Schrader, only a portion was. In effect, part of the bulge occurred because during the recessionary period, Public Defense Services Commission, as did a number of agencies, took a reduction in their budget. And the only way they had to handle that was to change some procedures, and in effect, what they did was push cases off so that those cases then appeared in the 2003-05 biennium. So some of that was unusual. But in effect, what happened during this last cycle was that the legislature chose to fund what in effect was the best estimate at that time of the essential budget level or of caseloads in effect. Unfortunately, it still used, it didn't have probably the right emphasis on the costs that would be attributed to these higher cost cases, such as the death penalty cases.
Right. Follow-up question. Would LFO concur about the projections of caseload, not including Blakely and certainly those other exceptional situations?
Senator Schrader, at this point, yes, we would. I think we all need to watch them closely. The projections do change, and one of the issues here is it's not on just necessarily a stable trend. Even the commission has to watch the nature of what comes in to the system. But I think as they're getting more information and more time that passes, that the justice system is stable under whatever the current law is, the better those estimates are. As policy changes occur, to that system, then once again we would all be watching those estimates and having to adjust for what was there. And then other things like the interpreters are some of those things that, again, I think they're getting a much better handle on, but other trends that occur could change those projections in the future. But for this biennium, I think we feel pretty confident about the projections.
Good. Thank you.
I think one of the things that we found over the years, and I know that many of the members here are aware of this, is that there are critical elements within the criminal justice system, and the Defense Services Commission being one of those. Obviously, we have a limited amount of funds available for everything in the criminal justice system, everything in state government. But Representative Patridge and I spent a great deal of time during the 2003 session trying to put the system back together. And when we were able to get funding back for the Criminal Defense Commission, what we basically had when cases started to be processed in the coming fiscal year then, in July of 2003, we had Let's Make a Deal, as that's what I would call it, because we had thousands of cases backlogged. A couple of my district attorneys basically plea bargain cases that they might not normally actually plea bargain, but just to clear the docket, basically, because there was a backlog and there were more people coming through the door. And so we don't want to actually repeat that, but I think you've been in enough of these meetings to know that our dollars are not limitless, and I think you've done a good job of managing those dollars. This is one of those critical elements, like forensics, is if you have major cases that require evidence to be reviewed, not having adequate forensic services can delay the system substantially. LFO.
Again, at this point, we would recommend the allocation of $3,926,500 from the General Purpose Emergency Fund and direct the agency to return to either the November-December meeting of the Emergency Board or to the legislature during the 2007 session for the remainder of the funding needed to cover the 05-07 costs.
The recommendation?
And just a final comment is that during the 2003 session, I've never had so many chiefs of police, sheriffs, district attorneys pleading for the criminal defense funds. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Senator Schrader, will you carry?
Sure.
Okay, we will go on to the two items for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And do you want to give us a review of both items?
Sure. You have before you both number 48 and number 49, Bureau of Labor and Industries. The first item, number 48, is to acknowledge receipt of a report on the prevailing wage rate unit, as required by budget note, and increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $41,635 and establish one wage and hour compliance specialist position, 0.38 FTE. Again, this is a response to a budget note. They have appeared before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, who also sends a recommendation to support this request. The second item before you, number 49, we're going to take them kind of together, is to increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $400,000 for increased Attorney General costs for the prevailing wage rate unit. And again, information provided indicates that at least in this biennium, some of it probably limited to this biennium, there was a large bulge in their costs related to the Attorney General for this unit, and this is to cover those costs. And again, we recommend approving both of the requests.
Okay. Commissioner Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm very pleased to be here before you today. As you may recall, in the 2005 legislative session, we sought approval of two FTE, which for wage and hour compliance for the prevailing wage unit. One was approved, and the second one, as LFO just told you, that we had to go on to the Legislative Audits Committee for recommendation, and they've recommended. The biggest thing that we've done with the prevailing wage unit since I came in is really predeterminations. What we are is a complaint-driven agency, and because complaints come in the middle, sometimes even toward the end of a project, suddenly they would be determined to be prevailing wage, and there would be additional cost unanticipated by the public agency that was involved in the project. So one of the things I work with the housing department, with the head of the housing department, Bob Repine, and others, was to really encourage predetermination so that up front going into a project, you'd know what you were facing, whether it was or was not prevailing wage. And so having done that, we have now had over 100 predeterminations this year alone. And this position really is for those predeterminations. It's to help us to accelerate them. One of the biggest problems with some of the public agencies at the moment is the speed with which we can get those predeterminations done. We actually just came before Legislative Audits Committee about a week ago to bring them our budget now, or bring us a performance measure, rather, to say that we would do our part within 15 days to see that those predeterminations are done. With the fluctuating interest rates that are out there, public agencies are wanting those predeterminations quicker. This FTE would allow us to make those predeterminations in a timely manner so that up front the agencies, the public agencies, that know whether or not it's a prevailing wage project. As to the other matter, as far as the expenditure limitation for Department of Justice funds, we really had three major factors come into play in the last biennium that increased our Department of Justice costs. The first was predeterminations, because we have the Department of Justice double-check our predeterminations and make sure that they agree with our analysis, and that's increased a lot of the cost. The second one was we held an 8-month task force on public-private partnerships. And during that, we were working intimately with the Department of Justice, and there was a lot of Department of Justice time. We also currently are meeting almost on a weekly basis with the Portland Development Commission to work with them on predeterminations, and we make Department of Justice time available for that as well. And, of course, some of our litigation is up. Additionally, so all those combined, there's higher Department of Justice fees than we had originally anticipated at the beginning of the last budget cycle. Both of these items are other funds. There is funds contained within the prevailing wage fund of other funds to allocate it toward these, and we just ask for your approval.
Yes.
Erica Kleiner with the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division, and DAS recommends approval of both requests.
LFO.
We also recommend approval of the requests.
Comments from the committee? Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a very critical underlying issue here that's not being addressed by this request, and that's the source of the conflict with respect to why these costs have increased. And they're pretty substantial. I mean, we're talking about a lot of money here. I guess my question, Dan, would be, to what extent do these costs reflect a change of interpretation of the prevailing wage statutes and application from past history to where we are today? And I just have some concerns, because there's a tremendous amount of effort from all parties that went into the task force to try to find resolution to this. That resolution has not been found, and now we're just continuing to spend money in a conflicting environment for projects. And I can just see this thing continuing to spin, and it's a big concern. We need to get this resolved. It needs to get resolved quickly. Spending this kind of money in these conflicting situations is not good policy, and it bothers me. And so, to the extent we could have some conversation around that, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, you bring up two or three things within your comments there. First of all, there is no change in interpretation from prior administrations on public-private partnerships. The first public-private partnership that came before the Bureau as a complaint to see whether it was prevailing wage or not was the Salem Carousel Project, and my predecessor determined it the same way I have with public-private partnerships as it relates to whether a contract for construction exists or not. As to the clarifying of the line as on public-private partnerships, I totally agree with you. That needs to be clarified. It needs to be addressed. That's why I had a task force together for 8 months trying to clarify that. The task force came very, very close, and there's several documents I can share with you that came out of the task force with some good guidelines for how to go about clarifying and brightening that line. And since the task force was unable to come to consensus, we have actually continued to work on clarifying that line in a number of ways. Most notably, last night, or yesterday afternoon, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I testified before the Portland Development Commission. The Portland Development Commission and I are working very, very closely now at looking at how to brighten that line. There's a much more collaborative spirit than there was toward the end of the task force today than there was at that time. I'm hoping out of the public hearings that come out of the Portland Development Commission, we had the first last night. There's two more to come about. I think they'll have their work done by early November on those public hearings. And I think we'll be able to work on a model that I hope we can bring to the next legislative session as a carve-out for public-private partnerships in the prevailing wage law that would brighten that line and make things much clearer for everyone.
As a follow-up, when would you anticipate having that accomplished?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, according to the Portland Development Commission's current timeline, they originally had their third meeting scheduled for November 7th till they discovered that was election night. And they've decided to postpone it a couple of nights, so I imagine their third hearing will somewhere before the 10th of November. They've offered me an opportunity to come before them to respond to anything that happens in the two meetings. So I would imagine before the end of November we should have a resolution if all goes as currently scheduled. Then we can come to you in January with a collaborative bill that would clarify and carve out for public-private partnerships in the statute, not affecting all other prevailing wage projects, what the triggers are that trip over the line to be prevailing wage for solely public-private partnerships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might make a comment, I can appreciate the dilemma that we're in, but in order to provide an additional sense of urgency to get this resolved before we just continuing to provide additional monies, I would be a no vote on this, but my encouragement is that I'm not sure that it's necessary today. If we bring this forward, actually we could resolve this issue early in the next session. But I'm not comfortable seeing this kind of money go out when we got this conflicting environment. And I just am not comfortable.
And Senator Morris, you're speaking in reference to being a no vote on item 48.
48 and 49, to the extent that we have anticipated future costs that we're budgeting, not just past costs.
Senator Schrader.
I appreciate my good friend and colleague's thoughts, but I draw different conclusions to this. I put this department through its paces with the Employment Relations Board positions and have been, I think, as thoughtful and constructive member are trying to make sure that things are done right. But to me, this is a win-win. I guess I don't understand. The PDC pulled out of basically the process, so I think it made the department's position very difficult. So if we want to send a message, let's send it to PDC. I will also point out that at the JLAC hearing, this new performance measure that is based upon getting the personnel to improve the performance was overwhelmingly supported. To get a decision in 15 days as a businessman, that is huge. That is huge. You know the shape of your universe up front, not 90 days or a year or whatever down the line. You have a much clearer, albeit not maybe perfect, line about where the department's going to be on this prevailing wage. I'd also point out that this whole issue on predetermination is a result of a new collaboration between private industry and public enterprises. This is great. This is something we've talked about. We did Senate Bill 71 with the transportation. We're trying to reach out and have the business community actually be able to partner to leverage both our limited resources to allow some of these huge projects to occur that some businessmen, some developers would not be able to do without that public component. If we're talking about continuous improvement, how do we get to this? What's a better, more efficient way than just dealing with legal battles over is this mostly prevailing wage or not prevailing wage, what portion of project is or is not? That is a very inefficient way to go about it, and that's the reason we have item 49 in front of us. I respectfully submit that by getting somebody up front to address these issues in this very timely manner is exactly the stuff, frankly, that you and I, my good friend, have talked about again and again, that agencies should be thinking outside the box, you know, come up with a new way to approach this and drive these costs down. So while it'd be nice to have that perfect bright line at this point in time, I don't think it's fair to single out the department as the cause, and I do feel that this is good for business, this is good for the taxpayer, and is a great leap forward, and we'll want to monitor, make sure those costs, those attorney general costs, do stay down, and it's productive, and well, if we don't do this, we won't get the information for next session.
Senator Morris.
Well, and I concur with your comments, Senator. However, we are approving not a limited duration, but a full-time position. So once this position is in, it's there. And if you resolve the underlying problems so that there is a bright line, and I appreciate the work that the Bureau is doing and our Commissioner is doing, but it just seems to me that we need to have some acceleration of those resolutions before we allocate a permanent full-time position and carry on down this road. I appreciate your comments, but I'm not convinced.
May I make another after?
Representative Scott. Well, I agree with most all of what Senator Schrader has said. I think that the JLAC and all of the various things that have been accomplished and the direction that we're moving will help this. I have to say that Senator Morris is somewhat persuading in his comments about this. I do believe, and we've had conversation with the prevailing wage, and I do want to get the thing resolved to where everyone happens to be on board and that we know. This is the part I don't agree with Senator Schrader. I'm not so sure it saves taxpayers money as much as it may save employers some headaches and potential money. So the only part I probably disagree with Senator Schrader is it probably doesn't help the taxpayers a great deal. It may the employers, but or hurt them, I guess. But at least it'll get them following the law of what is in place. Senator Morris is pretty persuading about the permanent position. So my encouragement would be it sounds like the commissioner has a timeline with the Portland Development Commission that there may get a resolution on this thing rather quickly. I would like to see I'm going to be supporting Senator Morris on this and withholding my approval. I would encourage that we move it forward quickly, and maybe that will, with the remarks that we've made, maybe it will help move PDC in a direction to be accommodating to get this this thing done. I don't want to have the cop situation, if you will, the enforcer situation come. I would much rather it be a compliance situation, that we know where we are in advance, and that the people that are doing these jobs accomplish that in the same fashion. I honestly feel that Dan has those same thoughts and would like to have that accomplished in the same direction. After we get that type of an agreement, I would be fully supportive if staff is needed to accommodate that we do that. But I would really like to see us try one more time to see if we can get an agreement and move it, rather than we force the agreement, so to speak.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could make a couple comments. You know, I'm in full agreement with Senator Morris and Representative Scott that we need to move forward, but by not approving this, you're actually hampering that, because I'm working with Department of Justice time with the Portland Development Commission without the expenditure limitation to allow to spend that money, which we have. I'd have to cease doing that. I'd have to cease having the Department of Justice reviewing our legal documents and our predeterminations. Our predeterminations would slow down dramatically, and it would hamper brightening the line in a lot of ways. Right now, one of the things the Department of Justice is doing for us to help brighten that line is putting a catalog of predeterminations together to work with public agencies to show them clearer where that is. But without the ability to pay the Department of Justice bills with an increased expenditure limitation, I'd have to cease operations of doing that. So by not approving it, it actually hampers our ability to brighten that line.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand what you're saying, I think what Senator Morris is I understood, make sure I understood it correctly, if you would, please, is that he does not want to move forward on 48. 49 would be agreeable unless some of the calculations of the limitation would be based on the additional FTE in 48. But I think that...
That's not true.
That's not true?
No, I mean that it's based on the cost of the additional position. No, 49 is all AG fees.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I wasn't clear what... I thought I heard Senator Morris object to both, but I'm...
Well, I did, Mr. Chair. in light of this discussion, I can appreciate that, you know, there's other issues here. To move into a full-time permanent position when you have this issue that's unresolved, I think is ill-advised. To accommodate the existing legal expenses that we have, I mean, obviously that obligation has been made, that needs to be funded, but some of that is prospective. A significant portion of that is prospective, and to the extent that this can be resolved, what I'm willing to say is, let's get this done. Let's get the conflict out of this issue and have a bright line, so that you don't have to have DOJ making interpretations and you know, these public-private partnerships spending tons of money as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I couldn't agree with you more. I want the line bright, and I've been working toward that for the last few years in trying to get people into a collaborative situation. We had an 8-month task force where, unfortunately, it was the public agencies that were not working in collaboration. They now are willing to work in collaboration, and we continue to work on it. By not approving the FTE, though, I'd have to stop or slow down dramatically doing predeterminations, which causes public agencies nothing but complete problems, because with the fluctuating interest rates on projects out there, they're not going to know what they're facing. I mean, my first priority is with investigations because of the obligation. Predeterminations is something I've set about doing because I believe it's good public policy, but I need this FTE to continue to do that, and there's no way we could meet a 15-day obligation of our performance measure without this FTE. So all it would mean to the public agencies is that predeterminations would take, virtually it could take 2-3 months instead of 15 days if we don't end up having enough staff people to address it.
Please go ahead, and then I'm going to have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator Morrison, Representative Scott, Annette Talbot, for the record, Deputy Labor Commissioner. I think that the Commissioner and I certainly, as we see the AG bill, share the concern about the rising AG costs. But I do think that two things are important to note. One is that the predeterminations, I do believe, do save public money, because if we can avoid the litigation down the way, then we don't have two public agencies suing each other. So that is clearly a benefit to all public agencies throughout the state, and we don't want to be engaged in that whenever we can avoid that. In addition, I think that the solution people are gravitating to may well require legislation. So if that is the case, that takes it out of our hands and back into your hands for next session, and obviously however long the session takes to resolve it. And I think the third point about the nature of the staff, we have had a complete turnover, almost 150% actual turnover in the last 4 years in that unit, because it is very tedious work. So by even getting it to an LD or preventing us from hiring a permanent person, we have such difficulty recruiting and training someone that it would be really hamper the agency. So we would urge you to reconsider on the position so that we can keep moving forward with public agencies. We are just starting to work with the League of Oregon Cities and seeing how we can set up a process to work to appeal predeterminations through our administrative hearings so you don't have to go to court, again, requiring staff time and AG time in order to get there. But that's where they want to go in order to reduce the conflict. So I think, unfortunately, in reducing the conflict, it does require that expenditure of the staff time and funds.
Senator Morse, I'm going to put out a recommendation on the table, not in the form of a motion, but just to see what the committee's reaction to it is. Commissioner Gardner and I used to share roles on a rules committee, so we're very accustomed to adjusting things that are before us, depending upon what the compromise has to be worked out. Would it be acceptable to the parties if we made the position a limited duration position? Accepted the LFO recommendation on the AG's funds, but made $300,000 of it upfront and unscheduled $100,000 of it based on actual costs. That way, DAS would monitor the actual costs. And also ask the commissioner to come back to this committee at our next meeting and report on the status of the discussions with the PDC. That basically would allow the commissioner to do his job, and would allow us to stay in contact with what's happening with this issue. Actually, quite honestly, just 37 days before the session starts.
I believe that's a reasonable approach, Mr. Chair. I could say
that. Senator Schrader.
Sure.
Is there a motion to that effect?
Well, I assume we're on measure on item 48, we're
right.
Hoping that this become a limited duration position.
Yes.
And that the commissioner would come back at the next e-board reporting on the progress for the PDC's discussions and others.
And you know the commissioner's going to shoot me after this for doing that.
And the other half to that, I think, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I think the other half to that, Senator Schrader, is the 300 on
item. We take that up under item 49.
Okay. So that's your motion on 48.
That's correct.
Is there any additional discussion of that motion? Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Playing dangerously. Okay. Senator Morse, will you carry that motion?
Yes. Carry the next one, too.
Yeah. We have the number 49. Do we have a motion? 300.
You're the official.
Okay, the official LFO recommendation and the DAS recommendation.
The official recommendation was to approve the request for an other funds expenditure limitation of $400,000 for increased attorney general costs.
And DAS's recommendation, sorry to be out of order.
Do we have a motion as previously stated?
As previously stated, which reschedules 400 to 300, leaving unscheduled
$100,000 for DAS to monitor actual expenditures. Any discussion of the motion? Any objection? Motion passes. I got some other items to give to people, so I don't want to load too many people up. Representative Scott, will you take that second one?
Sure,
49. Okay, now we are the Department of Higher Education. Mr. Bender.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You have three items, capital construction requests before you next from the Department of Higher Education. The first is for the construction of a large animal hospital facility at Oregon State University. The second is for an adjustment to a previously approved project for the Center for Health Professions at OIT. And the third is for phase two of the Research Stadium expansion at Oregon State.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Bob Simonton. I'm Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. And the Department of Higher Education is requesting your approval to modify the financing of OSU's Veterinary Medicine Large Animal Hospital project, which was approved in the 2005 session. We'd like seeking your approval to transfer $7 million of other funds limitation into Article 11F bond limitation. Now, $5 million of gifts have already been raised to date, and the remaining $7 million of the $12 million project would be bonds, which would be repaid from two sources. The first 3 years of debt service would be covered by an excess funds available from a bond sinking fund that was used to retire a 1971 bond that was originally used to construct a vet-med isolation facilities. And secondly, the remaining balance of the $7 million of bonds would be paid from endowment earnings from the OSU Foundation. And I'm joined by Mark McCambridge. He's Vice President of Finance and Administration with Oregon State, and he can provide some more information about the project and answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, good morning. For the record, I'm Mark McCambridge, Vice President for Finance at the University. I think Mr. Simonton has done a good job of explaining the overview. When the legislature approved this project during the last session, we believed that we would be able to raise all of the funds with private money. That has not occurred, but during that period of time, the College of Veterinary Medicine has also received a very significant endowed commitment on the part of an individual that will allow us to issue these bonds and repay the debt service on these bonds with the endowment earnings of that donor. And we would like to move forward as our four-year program is expanding, and we really need these facilities to accomplish that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
DAS recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill McCarthy. We recommend you approve the request specifically to establish in other funds capital construction Article 11F1 bonds a limitation, and to transfer $7 million from the existing other funds, other revenues expenditure limitation to the newly established limitation.
Okay. LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, LFO also recommends approval of the request. We would like to point out one circumstance relating to both this project and to the Research Stadium project, which is later on your agenda. And this is something which is rather unusual. I'm not aware of this having occurred before, but typically upon approval of this project, the project would proceed after you approved it. Capital construction projects are only brought to the emergency board when there is some reason why they cannot wait to the next legislative session, and we only recommend approving them if we also believe there's a reason why they cannot wait, and we believe that is the case here since the program has been expanded and the new facilities are needed. But The university will not begin construction of this project until after the general election, even though they would prefer to begin immediately. And the reason for that is the treasurer has advised higher ed that if Measure 48 passes, the proposed bond sale in March, that would be the actual sale of these bonds, might not occur, and that the treasurer would intend to confer with governor and the legislature in some form to determine which of the projects that have been approved but not yet financed because the bonds haven't been sold yet, which of those should proceed as you work through any of those issues. So it is potentially the case that even with this approval, this project will not proceed, but presumably in some format the legislature would look at this issue again in that particular case.
Any additional discussion? Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so there's a better understanding of this treasurer's interpretation of Measure 48, it's not that Measure 48 precludes the ability to issue the bonds. It becomes an issue of prioritizing to stay within the caps as to what is done and what is not done? Or could you elaborate further on that?
And can I interject in that and elaborate further on this? Yes. Part of that discussion, I believe, that I've heard from higher education is there's some question about the sources of revenue that would pay off F bonds in terms of whether they would be under the limitation or not. And in some cases, obviously, they would.
I believe that the proposed constitutional amendment would not exclude the bond proceeds themselves. So in this case, it would be the $7 million, and would not exclude the debt service payments on those bonds from the overall limit on statewide expenditures. So it is true that Measure 48 would not in and of itself prevent Article 11F1 bonds from being issued for this project, but it would be a question of, given that there would be constraints on the state budget that do not exist under current law, it would be a case where the treasurer feels like he would like to consult with the governor and legislature to see how to proceed given those new constraints.
And what I've heard in addition to that is there might be some constraints in terms of like student-related fees, in terms of how much those fees could increase, because they may come under 48.
They would come under 48.
And if you're depending upon those fees to, like, some of the other projects, to pay for part of the project, like a recreational facility or something like that, you may not have the projection in fees that you would have without that limitation, and so you may not be able to do the same level of project.
Yes.
So, any additional discussion? We have a motion.
Move the LFO recommendation and request.
Senator Schrader moves the Schrader Veterinary School recommendation.
I do not see any humor in that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Hearing none, any objection? Motion passes. Senator Schrader, will you carry?
Certainly.
Next item.
You want to give it?
Yes, this is a request to increase the expenditure limit that you approved in January for the OIT Center for Health Professions facility in Klamath Falls by an additional $1 million to be financed from gifts and donations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Again, Bob Simonton, Director of Capital Construction for the Oregon University System. The Department of Higher Education is requesting your approval to increase Oregon Institute of Technology's Center for Health Professions project, which was approved in the January Emergency Board, by increasing the other funds limitation by $1 million to offset construction-related inflation. Higher Ed does have a centralized contingency fund to absorb most normal inflationary costs. However, we've experienced a 40 to 50% increase in certain costs of building materials, which has been unprecedented. So I'm also joined by OIT's president, Martha Ann Dow, who can provide a little more information, brief summary, and answer some questions about the project.
Thank you, Paul. Chair Devlin and members of the committee, my name is Martha Ann Dow, president of Oregon Institute of Technology. We come before you today in the spirit of wanting very much to complete a very much needed expansion in our capacity in the healthcare field professional training area. We have done a great deal of value engineering over the last few weeks in order to come in within the budget of what it was at $11.2 million. We are asking for that additional increase so that we can fully continue to support our goal and vision of increasing by over 420 students by 2010. And this, of course, is to meet the tremendous workforce need capacity in Oregon. We want to fulfill the promise of opening this facility in the fall of 2007. We have raised the $1 million in gifts that we need to increase the cost on this project. We are not, therefore, asking you for additional bonding from the state to allow us to move forward. We have downsized the original building by 1,000 square feet so that the project, which would have been 42,000, will now be at 41,000 or thereabouts. I feel strongly that what we are doing on this facility, we have done our best at evaluating the cost of the construction, the inflation, particularly in steel and copper, that has hit us during this project. So, therefore, I thank you very much for your support today, if possible, and I would be happy to answer any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee, DAS, we recommend you approve the request.
Mr. Bender.
Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends approval of the request.
Any comment by the committee or a motion?
Move the request. No, you go right ahead, sir.
Thank you. This is a great, great program, and thank you for your work. How many students are we projecting total in the program, all classes, from incoming to graduation in phase two and then also in phase three?
We right now we're projecting to double our current enrollment, and our projected current enrollment in the first phase will be to move us up probably by about another 420 students, so it would get us halfway to our final goal, Senator Morris, so that by the time we get to our goals in 2010, we would have increased our enrollment by over 750 students, which would make our total population of students in that field over 1,400 students. And this is inclusive of a variety of modalities in allied health, particularly emphasizing imaging, and also adding some new programs that are on the horizon that are very much needed. Our second phase will also include the nursing collaboration that we have with OHSU, and so we are projecting in the nursing area in this facility to also go from a current number of students in that program of about 24 to close to 50 new nursing students in that second phase.
Follow-up question. Is phase two included in the priority list within OUS for funding in 07-09?
Phase two on the capital budget for the G-bond is included, Senator Moore.
Any additional discussion? Do we have a motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none. Motion passed.
Good luck.
Representative Scott, will you take that?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I figure I have to give Reeser Stadium to Representative Morse.
Mr. Bender.
Members, this is a request for a $33 million capital construction project that would expand Reser Stadium at Oregon State, construct a new weight and strength training facility, and purchase a new stadium video board. And the request would be financed by $27 million of Article 11 F1 bonds and $6 million of gifts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Bob Simonton, Director of Capital Construction for Oregon University System. The Department of Higher Education is requesting your approval to establish a $33 million expenditure limitation for Research Stadium Phase 2 project at Oregon State University. Much of the scope of work for this project was originally intended to have been performed in Phase 1, which was completed back in August of 2005. However, the 2005 project was scaled back to match the level of fundraising and anticipated revenues. Since the completion of Phase 1, additional donors and revenue streams have been identified to allow this project to be brought forward for your consideration. And again, I'm joined by Mark McCambridge to offer any comments or answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this project is much the reverse of our large animal hospital, which we were discussing earlier, in that private donations arrived at a higher rapidity than we originally had expected. This phase two we had planned to accomplish probably a year or two out, and the momentum of fundraising by the athletic department has allowed us to bring this to you. We feel very confident that with the private donations and additional revenue streams in our contracting with the media, that this is a solid project, and we ask for your approval. And I'd answer any questions. Other than our performance at Boise State.
I could ask, is I notice there's no expenditures here for noise suppression. When the visiting team from Eugene visits, they don't like loud noise.
I'll make a note of that, Chair.
They don't, I mean, they don't provide an intervention in the
Well, I guess we can get into a debate there, but anyway, the DAS recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from DAS, we recommend you approve the request.
LFO also recommends approval.
And for the record, I believe people will note that in no way has my bias affected any of my decisions on this committee in higher education.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Move their request and the recommendation.
Any additional discussion? Hearing none. Any objections? Hearing none. Motion passes. We have a quorum.
Thank you.
Senator Morse, please.
I'd be honored to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Board of Pharmacy. Yes, please come forward. Ms. Manby.
Hello.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, the Board of Pharmacy is here to present two reports. The first report is on proposed administrative rule changes related to wholesale distributors. During last session, the agency agreed to work with stakeholders on this effort and report the results to the emergency board. The second report addresses why Oregon needs a prescription drug monitoring program. This report was requested by the emergency board at its October 2005 meeting when the agency received approval to spend the planning portion of a federal grant that's been awarded to develop such a program.
Please present.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and I have with me Karen McLean, who is Administrative Director for the board. We have worked with BAM and LFO leading up to our presentation today. We've read both of their reports, and we agree with their analysis and their recommendations. you have our report in your packet with a number of handouts, and I know it's a fair amount of reading, and what I would propose, if it meets with the chair's approval, I would just zip through some highlights and then be prepared to respond to questions where you need some more detail.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
Which one are we doing first? Pharmaceutical wholesalers. In 2003-2004, the Oregon Board of Pharmacy and a number of other states had begun rulemaking and legislation to strengthen licensing requirements to protect the U.S. drug distribution system. The appearance of counterfeit, contaminated, adulterated, misbranded drugs was noticed all around the country. In fact, a cottage industry or gray market distribution system had been developing, and people were buying and selling drugs like commodity investments of frozen orange juice or soybeans, and some of them were not in that business to violate or clandestine distribution of bad drugs. They really thought that it was a commodity, and they were buying drugs at discounts as an investment, and knowing that they wouldn't use that many and would sell them. And most of the wholesalers were doing some of that. A few of them were bootleggers or whatever, and they used the system of lax distribution laws to introduce these contraband, counterfeit, contaminated drugs. 2005, Senate Bill 1004 was introduced. That was legislation increasing these licensing requirements for wholesalers. That bill was withdrawn. I guess you can officially withdraw a bill, but with agreement of the State Pharmacy Association and the industry, no further work was done on that bill, and a note was provided to the Board of Pharmacy to continue the rulemaking and make sure that you include the stakeholders. So the Board of Pharmacy issued a call to the stakeholders and developed an advisory committee. The list of members of the advisory committee is there with your report if you want to see who's on that. It was a broad ranging group. The board established a meeting schedule and a timeline for rulemaking. Rules have been proposed and noticed for public comment and hearing. We expect to have a public hearing in November and anticipate adoption of the rules in December. We did not provide a complete draft of those rules for you because it was about 35 or 36 pages, and I was hoping to buy some goodwill from the members by eliminating about 30 pages from your reading pile. In working with Ms. Manthe, we have provided her excerpts in response to specific questions, so there, she has seen some of that, and we can provide you with that if anybody wants to see the details of that rule. Highlights of the rule: there are really three new rules and five revisions to the existing rules that deal with creation and maintenance of records of sales, trades, and transfers of prescription drugs, verification of prior sales, creating a chain of ownership and distribution, new requirements for registration and annual renewal, and clarifying and listing prohibited practices for distribution of drugs. That's about where we are with pharmaceutical wholesalers. The prescription monitoring program, we were asked to respond to two specific questions, really. What is the nature of the problem in Oregon, and how is this problem going to be addressed by our program? And just going through the highlights of what we believe the program and what we've been saying is the program. The problem in Oregon is a lack of comprehensive data that ensures failure to identify problems. And that lack of data, lack of data collection mechanism ensures that lack of data will continue. Anecdotal reports of drug diversion and abuse exist all over the state, and we're hearing those. Reports from other states with data collection mechanisms identify and describe the prescription drug diversion and abuse problem in their states, and we extrapolate from that that we think probably Oregon is not the only state in the 50 that doesn't have a drug problem. If all the other states do, we probably do too, even if we can't draw a picture of it. federal reports from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, and the National Institute for Drug Abuse all indicate that there's a widespread problem of prescription drug abuse nationwide. In Oregon, there are piecemeal chunks of data that exist, and we have a couple of those in attached to your report. But we have just proven to ourselves what we've been saying, that there really isn't data to draw a good picture of what we see in Oregon. And reports and speculation from surrounding states with functioning programs indicate that drug seekers and doctor shoppers are crossing into Oregon where they can't be detected. So that's where we are with attempting to identify and describe the problem in Oregon. How will this program address the problem? The program will provide identifiable data to establish and describe the prescription drug diversion and abuse problem in Oregon. The program will provide needed de-identified data for research, education, and public health purposes. It will provide a mechanism to identify individuals engaged in diversion and abuse of prescription-controlled substances. It will provide a necessary tool for prescribing practitioners to monitor medication use of their patients receiving controlled substances. It will promote improved pain management throughout the state by eliminating the practitioner's hesitancy to prescribe controlled substances when it's appropriate for fear of being scammed. It will provide a statewide drug abuse prevention early intervention program that will establish a referral base for existing treatment programs. And it will eliminate the incentive for drug seekers and doctor shoppers to come to Oregon from surrounding states to avoid detection from their programs.
Thank you very much. Dan, recommendation.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Erica Kleiner, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division, and DASH recommends approval of the request.
Did you have anything additional you want to add? No, thank you. LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chair, members, LFO recommends acknowledging receipt of the two reports.
Is there any additional discussion? Do we have a motion to accept the reports?
Quick discussion, sir.
Yes.
I would hold, and I don't know what the performance outcomes are for the Board of Pharmacy off the top of my head, but to the extent that they play significantly in these new programs, I would hope that for next session there'd be some discussion. I don't want to have a proliferation of performance measures for the poor department, but these seem pretty important, and we're trying to accomplish some key things. So to the extent that this is brought forward next session, is something we want to figure out how to address and make sure we're doing it. It makes a difference. Go to all this work and trouble, and I appreciate the leadership of the Board of Pharmacy in both these issues. I want to make sure we're getting these results.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, the federal grant that the agency's been awarded actually has a fairly extensive requirement for performance measures, so I think we'll see a lot of good data out of that as
great.
Well.
Great.
We have a motion.
I'll move the recommendation. And,
do we have any additional discussion? Just one item. I met with the executive director on some other legislative items. And he and his staff were very thorough in providing the information that I needed. So I just wanted to say that I appreciate that. Without objection, motion passes. Before we end this meeting, if there's no objection, Representative Scott wants to be recorded on item number 9, the Department of Higher Education, OSU Research Stadium. Representative Scott, how do you vote?
Yes.
Is there anything additional? If none, we are done.
Thank you.